Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the type of delivery systems used in the August 21st chemical weapons attack in Syria that killed over 1,400 people, including 426 children. Theodore Postel, an expert on rockets and missiles at MIT, joins us to discuss his findings that indicate a much greater quantity of sarin gas, up to 50 times more than was previously estimated, were delivered per rocket, thus explaining a greater number of victims than there were from previous chemical attacks. Then, with much of the world's attention on Syria, we will discuss what is on the agenda at the G20 summit underway in St. Petersburg, Russia, where the host Vladimir Putin began the meeting by announcing that Syria was not on the agenda focused on reviving the global economy, but he did allow that some talk about Syria may happen over dinner. Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, joins us to discuss what can be done to reverse the global downturn with the engine of the global economy, the United States, hamstrung by Republican obstructionists, likely soon to again hold hostage the full faith and credit of the United States. Then finally, we will discuss Saturday's election in Australia, the outcome of which media baron Rupert Murdoch, who owns over 60% of the country's newspaper, is shaping to make sure the Tea Party-like right-wing party he is backing wins. Salvatore Barbones, a senior lecturer in sociology and social policy at the University of Sydney, joins us to discuss the tabloid trashing of the incumbent Labor Party by the ex-Australian kingmaker, who already tried to put his man in the White House when he attempted to recruit General Petraeus to run against Barack Obama in the last election. And joining us now is Theodore Postel, who is a professor of science, technology, and national security policy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Previously worked at the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment and as a science and policy advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations. He has won awards for uncovering and publicizing false claims about missile defenses, and he currently researches ballistic missile defense technologies, fraud in the U.S. missile defense programs, and works to reduce nuclear dangers in South Asia's and those due to the deteriorating Russian nuclear infrastructure. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ted Postel.
Oh, it's a very great pleasure to be here.
And the study that you did along with Richard Lloyd has been discussed in Thursday's New York Times. And I take it that what you're bringing to the table here is solving a mystery as to why there were so many casualties in this attack that happened on August the 21st in the Damascus suburbs. Then the previous, I believe the British now have said there were up to 14 previous uses of chemical weapons by the Assad regime. So is it entirely due to the work that you've done to identify this delivery system?
Well, let me start out by telling you what we know and also pointing out what we don't know. We're, of course, outside regular government, and so we don't have access to any special information. What Mr. Lloyd and I were doing is we were trying to understand these munitions from the chemical attacks, and there's a lot of photographic evidence that you can just get on the internet, and we have many tens of photographs of different rocket debris and pieces of rockets, and we were unable to understand how so much sarin or nerve agent could have been delivered in these circumstances. And by carefully sifting through all the photographs and trying to reconstruct how this munition works, we stumbled on the explanation. And it turns out that this munition is designed to carry a great deal more nerve agent than what the expert community who looked at this thing seems to have concluded. And there was a large exterior tank on the rockets that were fired that was torn away by the dispersal mechanism, which is a small explosive charge. And people were looking at the core of these rockets rather than looking at all the pieces associated with them, and they were assuming that the core had contained the nerve agent. Turns out that that's not true. The nerve agent was contained in a torus-like cylindrical-like structure around the core, and when you put together a model of the munition, it turns out to be a whopping big munition. It's carries probably 50 liters of this material, which is about 100 pounds of sarin, which is quite a bit larger than what people were saying or believed.
And this delivery system then sounds a bit like a cluster bomb mechanism, right? It explodes upwards on impact and disperses the munitions through the air, right?
Well, it's think of it as a one way to might you might think of it is it's not really like a cluster bomb. It's like a garbage can on the bottom of which has a small amount of explosives, and the garbage can is constructed so that its walls are very thin. And now it wouldn't normally be strong enough to hold up, but it's got this core, this tube running through the center, which basically keeps the garbage can from collapsing. And when the explosive goes off, it just blows the walls off the garbage can and creates a big mist of sarin, of material that, you know, this nerve agent, which physically has the properties of water. So if you wanted to understand, you know, if you wanted to get a sense for the physical behavior of the sarin, not the chemical behavior, of course, it's a toxic agent, but it has the same viscosity as water. It has the same volatility. It evaporates at the same rate. It's the same density of water. So if you just imagine you had a garbage can with a small amount of explosives in it, and it just blows this thing apart, and you have all these droplets blown into the air, and they start evaporating while they're suspended in the air, and you then get a column of air that is filled with this extremely toxic material.
And again, I'm speaking with Theodore Pestel, who is a professor of science and technology and national security policy at the Massachusetts Institute for Technology. Previously worked at the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment and as a senior policy advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations. He has won awards for uncovering and publicizing false claims about missile defense, and he currently researches ballistic missile defense technologies, fraud in the U.S. missile defense program, and works to reduce nuclear dangers in South Asia and those due to the deteriorating Russian nuclear infrastructure. Now, the fact that you have been a thorn in the side of the military-industrial complex, Ted Pestel, to my mind, gives
military,
you...
military-industrial academic complex, I should say, but go ahead.
Right.
Please.
Well, I'm just saying it gives you a lot of credibility in the sense that you don't have a dog in this fight because, there's a lot of people on the political left in the United States and around the world that are going through all kinds of mental gymnastics to try and attribute this attack to the rebels when the Syrian government has developed over the decades an extremely sophisticated and comprehensive chemical weapons arsenal as a deterrent against the Israeli nuclear bomb that they don't have. So this is their poor man's deterrent. So there's no question that the state possesses an enormous arsenals. I take it what you have discovered is that their delivery systems are much more sophisticated than were previously thought.
Yes, I would say the delivery system seems to be an extremely well thought out, indigenously engineered kind of munition, which is perhaps why it looks like the intelligence community may have misunderstood it, because they're probably looking for chemical munitions that look like things that other countries build. And it contains very large amounts of sarin, which one cannot rule out that these large amounts of sarin are possessed by rebel groups, but it's hard to imagine that so much sarin would be available to groups, you know, to a group other than the Syrian government. Of course, anything's possible, but this was a lot of sarin that was delivered.
And what's your sense then of whether it was a binary weapon? Binary weapon meaning that the toxic compounds are separated and then they're mixed when the weapon is fired for safety reasons. For obviously,
I don't think that was the case here. I think there was mixed sarin in these weapons. They may have been loaded a relatively short time before they were fired. The canister that contains the sarin has two pretty large. There's a flange on each, on both ends of the canister, and the back flange, which is attached to a rocket motor, has two quite large holes in it for filling the canister. And then the front of the front flange, which is the same diameter but has a different structure, has a single hole, which is for clearly for a chemical explosive fuse. So I can't say for sure, but there, we haven't found any evidence that there are multiple cavities in the container. So it would have been mixed sarin, as far as we can tell at this point. And it would have been premixed and used. And this kind of thing is not uncommon. The United States has a very high safety requirements, and so they like to have things separated. But this is probably loaded as toxic sarin right on the spot.
Well, the United States has agreed to get rid of its chemical arsenals, right? But it's hardly made a dent in them. And my understanding is that it's because these things are so toxic, they're extremely hard to dispose of.
Well, I mean, they are very toxic. And when you try to, you know, for example, if you want to burn it, you really can't allow it to burn without making sure you burn everything. Let me just give you a sense of how toxic the material is. If you had, you know, when you think of, if you had a teaspoon of this material, you could, and you could, I mean, this is not what happens, but let's imagine you could just distribute the minimal amount you needed to kill an individual from that teaspoon. You could kill maybe 200 or 300 people. I mean, that's pretty toxic stuff. Now, the reason it doesn't kill that many people is when you disperse it, of course, it gets dispersed into very large volumes of air. And, you know, there may or may not be people where it is. And, you know, there's a certain amount of breathing, you know, the density of the toxic material in the air and the amount of exposure people have, you know, varies dramatically. But if you just talk about the material itself, it's extraordinarily toxic.
Well, how would it explain then the fact that 426 children died along with over 1,400 people? Would it just have sort of drifted in the wind and air down into their bedrooms, or if they were in bunkers, would that explain it?
You have this container come in, and it's the rocket is falling. It's falling head first. It hits the ground, the explosive goes off, and then it creates a cloud of droplets. Again, you can think of it as water, a spray of water, spray of this toxic material.
Like a mist.
A mist, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's August in a desert area. This is a very dry area, so a lot of these droplets just evaporate very quickly. And you just have a gas, you know, you have this stuff is dissolved in the air in a very dense it's not really a cloud anymore. It's really a cylindrical-shaped region of air that has got a high density of this incredibly toxic material. And if we just use rough numbers, it might be 15 feet or even 15 or 20 feet in diameter and maybe 20 or 30 feet high, and it would sort of have the shape of, let's say, a soup can, you know, so it wouldn't be very large. But then the attack was at night, which is extremely important, because at night there's cool air that's close to the ground. This is a desert area, and there's not a lot of wind. And so what happens is this this soup can doesn't spread vertically at all, because there's no buoyant forces to in the daytime, this thing would spread vertically and would carry a lot of this toxic material to high altitudes where it wouldn't hurt people. But at night, when this attack was intentionally executed, what happens is the soup can spreads into a gigantic pancake, and this pancake drifts with the wind, maybe 1 or 2 miles per hour. And the pancake itself can become many hundreds of feet on a side as it sort of spreads out over tens of minutes. These attacks take time. Now, of course, if you don't know where it's coming from and people start convulsing around you, you don't know where to go. You don't know what's causing it. You don't know whether it's coming one direction or from the other direction. So it's a horrifying event from the point of view of the people who are subjected to this attack. They don't know what's happening. They don't have any means of knowing what's happening or any means of taking shelter, because they don't even understand. There's no way for them to understand what's evolving around them. And as this thing drifts downwind, it can kill people at, thousands of meters downwind. So now if people are inside the house and the windows are closed, they may get some of this drift into the room through cracks and things, and they may, but it will tend to stay in the room after the cloud leaves. So actually having closed windows in a room, unless you took special precautions to seal the room, might actually be as bad or worse than being in the open when the cloud hits, although you get a lower level of toxic material in the air, but you'd be in the room for a longer time. It would be trapped there with you. And so one of these things landing in a highly populated area, in a desert environment where people are probably sleeping with windows open, it's perfectly plausible. I can't say I know what happened, because I wasn't there. I don't have those data. But munitions of this kind could certainly have killed people on this scale. No question about it.
So just in closing then, Ted Postol, again, a professor of science, technology, and national security policy at MIT. You're a scientist or physicist, so you deal with scientific fact. Why is it that we're having such a difficult time? I understand why, Putin, for example, is denying that Assad did it, because that's his client. But why so many people in the West keep insisting that this ragtag bunch of rebels pulled off this sophisticated attack?
Well, it's hard for me, quite honestly, it's hard for me to know. But what I would say is that it's if you had to guess based on what we know, it's very hard to you can't rule it out with certainty, but nothing can be ruled out. Very few things can be ruled out with certainty. If you had to guess, the overwhelming evidence indicates that it had to be the Assad government. I mean, it's just the amount of materials you would need, the ability to execute this sophisticated attack would have to be from a pretty well-organized entity that had a lot of resources. Now, today you have, first of all, the government is not trusted by many people. And quite frankly, I don't trust the government. There's been a lot of lying to people. it has become almost it's acceptable to deny facts that are as clear as basic science. I'm involved with an argument with our National Academy of Sciences where they clearly published something that was absolutely wrong, and I confronted the leadership of the National Academy, and they come back to me, and they write a letter, and they say, well, it's a matter of opinion.
Well, and this is about the bogus...
This is the National Academy of Sciences.
Right, and this is about the bogus missile defense program, right?
Right, yeah. Right. So you produce a report that's transparently wrong, mm-hmm. that anybody who is competent... I mean, you can't expect the public, the general public, to understand, but the National Academy of Sciences leadership tries this phony argument that it's a matter of opinion. We're pointing at refereed papers that have been accepted as correct for 40 years.
Sure.
And they're saying it's a matter of opinion. So it's just gotten to a point now where nothing, no fact matters, and people in positions of authority and responsibility use the facts any way they think they can twist them to their ends. Mm-hmm. So
we're in a fact-free zone here, and the truth's a moving target. And I thank you so much for joining us here today, Theodore Postol.
You're very welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Theodore Postol, who's a professor of science, technology, and national security policy at the Massachusetts Institute for Technology. Previously, he worked at the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment and as a science and policy advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations. He's won awards for uncovering and publicizing false claims about missile defenses, and he currently researches ballistic missile defense technologies, fraud in the U.S. missile defense program, and works to reduce nuclear dangers in South Asia and those due to the deteriorating Russian nuclear infrastructure. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with an economist about what the real agenda is supposed to be at this current G20 summit underway in St. Petersburg, Russia.